You've tuned in to a very special episode of the Roundtable Podcast, More Than 20 Minutes with Patrick Rothfuss. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robison, flying solo for this very special edition of the Roundtable Podcast. Brian was unable to attend this epic installment, and trust me, he's kicking himself. The reason for this extra episode is so fabulous, I'm actually going to forego my usual lengthy and overblown introductions and cut right to the chase. Dear friends, joining me on the Skype line today is the author of The Name of the Wind and Wise Man's Fear, host of the fabulous Geek and Sundry series, The Storyboard, and owner of the Beard of Power. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the big chair at the round table, Mr. Patrick Rothfuss. Pat, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a treat.
Oh, man, for us as well. For us as well. And I'm using the us in plural for my co-host who is not here. It's not the royal us. It's just him who would be here if he could. So, Pat, let me give you some background. On the Roundtable Podcast, we brainstorm story ideas with writers and authors. So the premise behind the Storyboard series, the gathering of authors to discuss craft, really resonates with what we do. And we've discovered, as I'm sure you have, the incredible creative mojo that seems to be inherent when you get creative folks in the same room talking. And I was curious about your opinion of the whole shared worlds writing model and collaborative writing in general. How much of a role has collaboration played in your own works and experience?
Well, you know, I've always kind of thought of myself as a feral writer. And I'm sure it's a case of the grass is always greener somewhere else, but I've known people who have like these thriving writing communities, you know?
Sure.
Like folks that live in Portland and they get together with other professionals and they went to conventions and they went to workshops and you know, I took a few classes when I was in college and I had a few friends and we all kind of wrote. But, you know, that was like way back in the day. We were all kind of dabblers at that point. But I never really had like a community of people who were really doing it seriously. And so I kind of grew up in the wild without a lot of that support. And aside from that, like the kind of community, you know, collaboration is a whole step beyond that. You know, the thought of actually writing something with someone, that not only means you have to like work with them and interact with them and talk about the concept with them, but it's a whole different level where you're actually, you know, building the same house, so to speak. And it's fascinating and terrifying to me, the thought, that very thought. Because I'm such a control freak when it comes to my writing.
Really?
Oh, God. It's. I think I can probably say without, you know, without offending anyone out there, that I probably revise more than maybe anyone else in the industry.
Really?
And I don't think I'm overstating it there, because I talk to some other people and they're like, yeah, I do, you know, three, four drafts, you know, and they get feedback in between. And I know Butcher has his beta readers and, you know, he gets feedback from them. But like for my first book, again, which is atypical, I probably had like 200 beta readers.
Well, you were working on that for like 10 years though, weren't you?
Exactly. So that's not a good example. But even for book two, I had at least 70 or 80 beta readers. And I read the book myself at least 150 times.
Editing, correcting, nudging, tweaking.
Bedpenning and really, so like really making sure that every word, and really, is that more than I needed to do? maybe. I hope to streamline my process in the future. But to go from that to suddenly like sharing that with another person, you know, I worry that I would have an episode. You know, I'd break down on some level.
Well, but I would imagine that, I mean, now granted, on the storyboard, on Geek and Sundry storyboards, you're not developing ideas per se, but you are, you know, sharing insights and perceptions of craft and the specific elements that each episode addresses. Have you found that has been altering your own strategies or perceptions in your work?
Yeah, and that is something that I very much enjoy. Collaboration in terms of a specific work freaks me out, but like actually meeting other professionals and not just professionals, like you can have really great conversations about writing with anyone who writes, or honestly, they don't have to be writers either. Readers really think about this stuff a lot.
Sure.
So that's what I've been enjoying over these last 5 years or so. I've been going to conventions. At first I sat in panels and listened to people talk. And then more and more I was on the panels talking about the writing. And I love that discussion. I could do that all day. And at some conventions I have just talk all day about how to build worlds, how to present characters, how to, you know, make dialogue realistic. That discussion of the craft is fascinating to me. It's one of my absolute favorite things.
Sure, sure. Can you reference anything in specific, maybe from the storyboard or from those discussions that you feel has altered the way that you approach your writing?
Well, a lot of times it takes a while to digest because
sure.
One thing I have noticed is that the longer you've been doing this, you kind of become more and more sure of yourself that, you know, your way is the truth and the light and the path. And so a lot of times you get into a discussion, and if everyone agrees, and then everyone's kind of happy, but it's boring.
Sure.
That's one of the things that I like, and it's one of the things I try to select my guests for on the storyboard, is I want people that are informed, of course, and I want people that are articulate about what they know, of course. And I want people that are polite, of course. We want to have a civilized discussion.
But so much drama would be if you could actually get into a frothing argument about it.
And that's key, is you really need people who are willing to disagree. And I thought I might have to coach people a little bit more. But luckily, you know, writers being who they are, it was in the very first episode where I kind of threw something out there I was pretty sure of. I think I was talking about, like, what makes urban fantasy so appealing.
Right.
I threw it out there thinking this will make me seem very clever and insightful. And everyone was kind of thoughtful. And then somebody goes, no, I don't think that's it. And then they launch into their own theory. And then we had a good discussion.
Sure.
If you don't disagree, then there's no dialectic and nothing, you know, you lose a bunch of potential coolness in the discussion.
Sure, sure. Well, and as you say, each writer, after having done it for a measure of time, has come to their own truth, their own awareness, and probably just a level of maturity that it allows for the fact that your truth is not necessarily the truth and is open to discussion and consideration.
That's it, exactly. And that is the nice thing about most of the authors that I've run into at this point, is they've figured out, you know, a lot of pretty good ways of doing it, but I've never really run into someone who's so arrogant as to think that they have the only way to do it or the best way to do it.
I think you may be lucky in that respect, Pat.
Well, I'm not saying that they aren't out there, but, well, and the truth is, you know, I think there is something in the writer personality that leads to a certain, you know, megalomania. I mean,
sure.
There's a reason that, you know, the word authority, it has author, right, built into it. Just the act of creating these worlds and telling stories in them is kind of a supremely, you could almost call it an act of real egocentrism. You know, it's like, I am going to build a world and create these stories. And so you kind of have to have a little bit of ego, I think, even to endeavor in that.
Sure.
But you know, the truth is, I have never run into, you know, of all the authors I've met in these last couple of years going to these conventions, everyone has been so graceful and so, you know, intellectually articulate and willing to discuss. It's been one of the best parts of being a published author.
That's awesome. Yeah, we found the same thing on the roundtable. So many different diverse perspectives, and all of it ultimately can be woven together in your own unique way of application.
Yep.
I wanted to ask you. I think it's safe to say that artists in general and writers in particular look at the world differently. And that a writer, for example, experiences movies and books and games through a different perceptual process. And I was wondering, are you aware of any mental processes that are running in the background of your brain that transform that input into storytelling fuel? how do you keep your creative fire stoked?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think Neil Gaiman wrote about that somewhere, where he said, you know, he talked about part of his writer's mind, and he said that, and it was in part of a larger story or a larger musing about something, where he talked about, it was the part of his mind that, like, even in the middle of a car wreck, he looked at, like, the way the broken glass had blood on it and thought, I could put that in a story at some time.
Right.
And that's kind of what I think everyone thinks of in that, where, like, you're in the middle of breaking up with your girlfriend and you think, I'm going to write about this. But, you know, I think that's a fair way to demonstrate that process. But it's a little Hollywood. It's like only the car wrecks and breakups and, you know, the hospital visits would kick that off for a writer. But for me, it's not like that. I used to take classes, and I'm learning about anthropology, and I'm like, that's interesting, you know, or I'd be taking an English class, and I'm like, huh, the word Aeolian is interesting. And then I'd learn about medieval theater, and I'm like, you know, that's interesting. And really, when I started working on the book, suddenly everything was interesting. It was interesting before because I'm a very curious person, but suddenly it's like, oh God, here's an awful analogy. You know, those little flash games you play where some things are clickable and some things are not?
Sure, sure.
It's sort of like, suddenly, everything in the world became clickable. I mean, you know, suddenly everything in the world was potentially of more use because it could be woven into my world that I was creating. And if not the story itself, then just the world. The more you know about people and religion and politics and anthropology and language, those things all suddenly become grist for your mill if you're a certain kind of writer. I don't think everyone is like that, but I certainly am.
That's fascinating. So basically what you're saying is that the process, the act of actually starting to write, actually awaked?
Sure. I'm good with awoken.
We'll go like with awoken. Awoken that perspective and that, we'll make shit up as we go. Absolutely. that perspective, that sensitivity to those opportunities that the world unfolds. That's intriguing.
I can almost think of it as a sort of love for the world. Because I don't know if it was like this for you, but like when you were younger, right? And we were all kind of dewy-eyed and fresh and naive. And you first fall in love, and like everything you look at, you think, oh, you know? I could tell her about this.
Yes.
And honestly, the book is the same way. And I always think of it in my head as the book, even though at this point, the book is many books. I think, ooh, this can be useful for the book. And so, you know, I do, it sounds a little weird to refer to it as an act of love. It's certainly not romantic love. It's not sexual love. It's almost, you could maybe pin it on agape. The right. Greeks had this great word for this other kind of love. I heard it once referred to as that love which instills worth.
Sure.
And that's that's kind of how I feel about it. You know, you're working on this project and suddenly the world is richer than you ever realized.
Almost a reverence.
Yeah. You know, and it makes everything kind of cool. You do kind of wake up to the world in that way.
Which I would imagine is simultaneously empowering and humbling as well. When you realize that everything around you, as you say, is grist for the mill, the act of selecting and choosing which of those precious elements will be utilized and you know, placed as a showcase, as a on the altar, as it were.
Yeah, it can be a bit much.
We'll be back with more of our discussion with Patrick Rothfuss after this brief promotional break. Storytelling has been a part of our lives since the dawn of civilization. But to this day, authors and readers still discuss and debate the perfect blend of character, plot, and setting to craft a great story. Now you can be a part of that discussion. Geek and Sundry presents a remarkable monthly series titled The Storyboard. Hosted by Patrick Rothfuss, author of The Name of the Wind and Wise Man's Fear, each episode is a live panel discussion on the very essence of the writer's craft. Gathering a different constellation of stellar authors for each panel, The Storyboard offers up a live discussion that is vibrant, diverse, and sometimes contentious, but always relevant to today's dynamic world of storytelling. The Storyboard discussions occur on the first Tuesday of every month at 8 p.m. Pacific Time on Google Hangouts. Just subscribe to the Geek & Sundry YouTube channel or add Geek & Sundry on Google+ to receive notifications. The Storyboard, continuing the quest for how to tell a great story. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Patrick Rothfuss.
I've heard, I can't remember who said it, or, you know, honestly, maybe I said it and then read it and then thought it was clever.
There you go.
Which is an awful thing. But I think some writers, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't me, but they referred to it as the junkyard, where, you know, you get all this stuff, and it is kind of just junk. And that doesn't mean that it's not beautiful, and it doesn't mean that it's not useful. It just means that it's stuff that ordinary people wouldn't necessarily value.
There you go.
You know, like the glint of light on bloody glass. A writer takes that and puts it in the junkyard because later when you're rummaging around trying to build something, trying to make your art, trying to build a house, then maybe you need, you know, that glint of light. Sure. I also heard at one point somebody say that, a man walks down the street and thinks about what it would be like to write about walking down the street. And that sort of person is a writer. And there's another sort of person, and he walks down the street, and he wonders why people are the way they are, and he doesn't know. And so he makes up an answer, and that answer is his novel, and that person is a novelist.
Huh.
And I don't know if I agree with that, but it is a very interesting take where some people might... It might be the difference between fiction and nonfiction.
Sure.
Some people want to write what is. They want to write about a man walking down the street. And some people concern themselves with what if. And those are the fiction writers.
Sure. Well, and there's also, you know, there even within genre fiction, there are those very representational storytellers that fill their worlds with detail and their characters with authenticity. And then there are others that infuse almost a lyric poetry to it where there actually seems to be something that they're trying to say. There's something that they're trying to express.
Absolutely. Have you ever read Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics?
Oh my God, yes. I have all three of the books sitting on my shelf. Marvelous stuff. Blood in the Gutters.
Oh God, yes. I read that early on, and it changed the way that I thought, not just about storytelling, but it changed the way I thought about stories. And he talks about like the progression of an artist from looking at the surface, you know, where, you know, and he talks about it in terms of art and comics, right. But I think it's really appropriate in all types of art and storytelling. And he goes from the surface to a little bit more of the underpinning, like being able to trace something off a page as opposed to like drawing something yourself, as opposed to actually knowing how the musculature and the articulation of a hand works and drawing it accurately. And then it ultimately comes down to his theory was either you're experimenting with form or with idea. And either you're a writer of form or idea, or of course a combination of both.
Sure.
And I do think you're right though. Some authors have something to say. Their books are, how about this? I don't want to say their books are about something or their poems are about something, because all stories are about something.
Sure.
But some stories do seem to have a certain gravitas. They mean. And I'm not saying that they mean something. It's not a rough allegory. It's not.
Or a moral or something, right.
Yeah, that's whorish and that's heavy-handed. But some things mean. Some things signify. Some people are not turned off at the thought of talking about like a platonic capital T truth these days. And that's a certain kind of artist. And then there's other types of artists that do other things. But yeah, I think you're right that trying to be about something is one of the types of writer out there.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was reading a blog post recently and I forget who it was. It was an author talking about their writing process and talking about how when they're writing their book, they envision somebody, not a specific named individual from their life necessarily, but there is an ideal reader or the person to whom the book or the story they're writing is being addressed to. Do you have that in your experience, or is your process a much broader, just getting the story down and let the readers take from it what they will?
That's an interesting question. I do think about my audience. I don't think about one singular kind of idealized reader. I think about the reader, you know, like the your ship in some ways. Knowing that, you know, and boy, you know, talk about, you know, a great topic. We're going to eventually have a whole issue or a whole episode of the storyboard that's just about audience.
Excellent.
You know, how do you cope with the fact that, you know, a 14-year-old kid can pick up your book, or a 70-year-old grandma can pick up your book?
Sure.
And so I've always tried to make my audiences broad. I try to write to a really broad audience. But at the same time, I assume that that audience is smart. Okay. I assume that if they don't know what the word alloy means, they can look it up or figure it out from the context. So I don't want to coddle them, but at the same time, I don't want to be obtuse, you know, and
sure.
And just, you know, and make them work needlessly.
Are there other qualities to that readership that you ascribe as you write?
You know, and sometimes I go back and forth. I always thought I wanted people to be able to read my books. And if they had read a bunch of fantasy and gotten bored with it, this would hopefully be kind of fresh and new to them.
Rekindle that love.
Yeah. But at the same time, I hoped that if somebody had never read fantasy, then this book would still be interesting to them.
Okay.
So in some ways, I was writing for two very separate audiences there, and I put different things in the book for those different audiences. And I wouldn't recommend this as a technique because it took it took me ages to try to get it right. And even then, there was a fair amount of luck involved. But I did think, you know, some readers read because they love language, a good portion of them. So because I love language, you know, I'm going to put some beautiful language in there for them. Okay. But I didn't want it to be so much that it would turn people off if that's really not what they were coming on board for.
It's a delicate, fine line to walk.
Yeah, well, and you can do that with almost everything, because sometimes in a fantasy novel, the payoff is in the exploration of this fantastic world. So I wanted a cool world for people who wanted that, but I didn't want so much that it would bog down the readers who were coming for something else.
Sure.
I wanted, you know, good action for people that wanted action, but not so much action that it was going to turn off people who were mostly there for other things, you know? And I did. I really, like I said, I don't recommend that as a way to do it.
Unless you have 10 years to edit your book.
Exactly. I am not a role model, folks. You don't want to follow in my particular footsteps because, you know, anybody who works on their unpublished, you know, 500,000-word fantasy trilogy for 12 years and it's not published, it's sad, you know? It's like, I was kind of a sad bastard for a long time, and my friends made fun of me, as they should have. You know, that is well worth mocking. And the fact that on year 13, I finally got an agent and people were interested in the book, doesn't mean that I was smart all the way through there. It means that I clung to this thing like a piece of driftwood, and then I got lucky. You know, it probably would have been much smarter to do it like Brandon Sanderson did. Write a book, set it aside. Write a new book and get better at that. Set it aside. You know, because Sanderson wrote, 11 before he finally got published?
Right, yeah.
I think he and I bookend the spectrum in terms of this process.
Well, and you know, personally, Pat, I'm of a mind that timing is everything, and that the passion, I mean, if anything that we can take from your personal experience is that the passion and commitment to your story sustained you through those dozen years, mockery or not. so that when the time was right and the stars aligned and whatever, you were prepared to answer the call and with a beautiful, beautiful story.
I got very lucky with the timing. I found the right, you know, the right publishing house, the right editor. And I think that the reading community in general, the fantasy reading community had matured to the point that where they were ready for this sort of story.
Sure.
You know, I don't think I would have gone over nearly as well 10 years ago. If I came out now, I wouldn't do as well now. So much of it is luck. It's just pure dumb luck.
Sure. But you can't hang your hat on that.
No. When you get your lucky break, I always tell people this, at some point you will get a lucky break. And when that happens, you better have something to capitalize on that with.
Absolutely.
And that should be a manuscript that shines like a diamond.
There you go. That's what to take away from all that. Pat, I'm looking at the time and I'm seeing it's winding down. I got one more quick question for you.
Yeah.
Every writer brings something unique to the literary table. And I was curious, what do you consider your greatest strength as a writer? And what do you do to foster and nurture that strength?
Good Lord. What is my greatest strength as a writer? If I had to pick something that was kind of mine and nobody else's, it would probably be that obsessive tendency towards revision. The phrase that I like, it was actually, used by my friend Robert, who runs Geek Chic. He said, "The pursuit of perfection in the face of sanity." And, you know, I would really like to try to make something perfect, even if that is not entirely sensible. But, you know, I'd have to think about that. I don't know if that is, you know, actually a superpower that I have, or if that might be actually my kryptonite.
Is it a bug or a feature? We don't know.
Right. But that is the nice thing about Storyboard, is everybody gets to come on, discuss their different processes, discuss their, you know, their different take on all of these things, and then share it with the world, other writers, even just readers, you know, folks tuning in, I think get to see storytelling, not just books either. You're right, games, comics, the whole thing. It's all stories. And on the Storyboard, hopefully that's what we're going to continue doing, is looking at all of these stories and kind of seeing how they work inside. What makes them tick?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And dear friends, if you have not tuned in to the Storyboard, do make that scene. There's, what, 2 episodes up now, Pat? Is that right?
We've got 2. We come out with a new one, broadcast live on Google Plus Hangouts through Geek and Sundry. The first Tuesday of every month at 8:00 Pacific time. And if you can't make that time, it's no worries, because it's archived on YouTube for all of eternity.
Wonderful. And the first one was urban fantasy. The second one was character, an all-star lineup on both roundtable discussions, and some wonderful, wonderful insights. Really, you've done a marvelous job of piecing together a diverse set of perspectives on each of those so far. And I for one, am looking forward to seeing who all comes on in future episodes.
We've got some really great people lined up. My only regret is that I know from experience, like, a 6-person panel is too many. That's especially if they're really informed on the subject. So I'm holding it down to just 4 of us at a time. Next month, we're hoping to get Terry Brooks in, and I'm putting together a panel around him. So we're going to have a great one this upcoming month, and hopefully in the months to come.
That's awesome. So friends, first Tuesday of every month, Google Hangouts, 8 p.m. Which time zone?
8:00 at Pacific time zone.
Pacific,
and
okay.
You can get all the heads up if you subscribe to the Geek and Sundry YouTube channel, or if you add them on Google Plus.
Outstanding. So friends, and Pat will make sure all of that gets into the liner notes. Excellent. And I see our time has run out, alas, because we could just keep on doing this. Pat, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing so generously. This has been marvelous.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, I'd be happy to come back anytime. Just give me a ring.
Oh, see, outstanding. I think we can make that happen. Friends, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this more than 20 minutes with Patrick Rothfuss as much as we did, or I did. Poor Brian, he's just sitting there going, damn it, curse fate. But stay tuned. The rest of the feed rolls out as scheduled, but we had to drop this in because this is such a glorious opportunity. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you have comments, leave them on the comment board, reviews on iTunes, emails at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. I'm just going to sit back and have a cigarette now because that was fabulous. We'll talk to you again oh so very soon. Until then, you guys stay frosty, be awesome, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.